Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by our man in Limpopo, Mr. Tieko Tsotse. Tieko, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing good things, and how are you, Nick, sir? Good afternoon, Marius, and to
very good.
All the viewers.
Yeah. And of course, we also have Mr. Marius Root, who is back once again in the motherland in fine, sunny South Africa. Marius, how are you doing?
Right, new, had a nice, good welcome to South Africa. Didn't have any electricity this morning, so I had to go work in a coffee shop, which was great. So, man, Eskom is, making out and it's always good to be back. And,
exactly. It's like walking around your own, your old decrepit hometown where everything is broken down. Anyway. Before we get into the news stories of today, just a word from our sponsor, and we are once again sponsored today by Bitvice. Bitcoin is the complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South African-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their clients' Bitcoin with them. That is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your own Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. They don't hold your keys. They don't hold your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. So we thank them very much for sponsoring us. So let us get into the news of the day. And once again, we have chaotic coalitions and much excitement at local government level. And this time it happens to be in Nelson Mandela Bay, formerly known as PE, or currently known as Kapega. It's got sort of three names, which always makes it a little bit complicated. But anyway, the Nelson Mandela Bay municipality is having a vote of no confidence in its ANC mayor at the moment. So just as the ANC seems to be leveraging the DA out of power in Joburg, the DA looks like it's trying to leverage the ANC out of power in Nelson Mandela Bay. So I believe the vote is ongoing and the council sitting is ongoing. However, it had to be suspended recently in the last couple of hours, and I'm not sure if they've restarted again. As the one of the DA councillors has claimed that they have received death threats for their vote of no confidence in the mayor. And the council has been suspended while the DA's chief whip reports to the speaker the death threats, and I think they're going to lay criminal charges or something like that. So anyway, pretty dramatic stuff. And remember that, of course, Nelson Mandela Bay has seen violence in the council before. Andile Lungisa, of course, was convicted of assaulting a DA councillor in that same municipality a while ago when he hit him on the head with one of those heavy glass jugs. And luckily didn't injure him too badly, but it was still a pretty nasty injury. Maurice, what do you make of this? Firstly, I mean, there's two issues here. The violent, the sort of threats of violence stuff, but then the second issue is that, what are the DA's chances of success, do you think, in chucking the ANC out here?
Well, it seems like it's going to be a tricky one. I think what's more worrying is that people are getting death threats from opposition parties and so on. And we all know that the killing of ANC councillors by what's probably other people in the party is quite common. But seems it's especially in KwaZulu-Natal, but it seems it's starting to happen in the rest of the country. I know that DA councillor in Mgaini, which is the only DA-run municipality in KwaZulu-Natal, was also attacked. So I think we need to really, I mean, this is something that really needs to be nipped in the bud. It's not a big leap from death threats to actual killings and so on. So it's definitely something to be worried about. But also just shows you it's something we're going to have to live with in South Africa is with these coalitions, which are all pretty, they're pretty unstable, I think. But it's all, that's how the South African electoral system works with this proportional representation. You know, coalitions are going to be, increasingly a feature of government. We're going to have the coalition at national government level pretty soon, maybe 2024, definitely from 2029. So it's, I think it's we're going to have to see some maturity within our political parties where they work together and we don't see this kind of instability in municipalities and one of these days, a lot of our provinces and the national level, you know, it's not good for the residents of a place. And yeah, I think this is part of it. But it sort of shows you the how difficult it is to manage these coalitions. This new coalition that's trying to get rid of the ANC in Nelson Mandela Bay. One of the partners is the PAC. But the PAC has also been working with the ANC and the EFF in Johannesburg to get rid of the DA-led coalition there. So it's all quite complicated and tricky. And yeah, I mean, but as you were saying before the show, the DA might lose Joburg, but they might gain Nelson Mandela Bay. So, you know, it depends, I suppose, where you are from in the country. Some people say poor DA, and other people say, oh, that's much better. I'll take PE over Joburg. I don't know if I'd agree with that. But yeah, we'll have to see what happens there. But I think what's the most, you know, thing that we have to take from the story is the fact that a DA councillor has received his death threat. Who knows how serious it is? But it's definitely something to worry about and to look into. And it's not something that we can allow to become common in our politics.
Right. And it's not the first time the DA has made accusations like this. Recently, actually, they made a similar kind of accusation against the ANC, saying that the ANC had bribed some of the smaller parties in specifically not the parties, the coalition councillors themselves in Johannesburg to switch their votes and vote out the DA speaker there in that municipality. And in fact, there was a DA councillor who has laid criminal charges against some ANC councillors in Joburg, claiming that he was offered 2 million rand in order to vote a certain way in Joburg. Votes of no confidence, which is pretty crazy stuff. Tiego, what do you make of all this? Firstly, the issue of skullduggery, and secondly, what do you think this says about our coalitions going forward international?
Well, firstly, I think I must say that I absolutely believe the DA councillor. Well, I can't say that I absolutely believe him because there's no evidence, but I have reason to believe him. Back in 2017, I got to work on the CR17 campaign. I was part of the CR17 campaign in my professional capacity as a communicator. And I remember at one given time arriving in the Free State to do that very work with many politicians, including the former mayor of Mangaung. And, you know, just arriving there as part of the CR17 team in my professional capacity, by the end of the week, I was probably offered tenders that could amount to around 15 million rands. So it is the nature of the African National Congress to operate in this manner. I must say, to the very point around the PAC...
Tiego, you clearly made the wrong choice if you're sitting here today.
I think I made the right choice. But it the nature of their politics, right? Regarding the PAC on one side in Johannesburg being with the ANC, on the other side being with the DA, for me, it's not surprising at all. I mean, since the inception of the PAC, since it was founded, I don't think we've seen a single policy document from the PAC around local governments and stuff of that nature. So they don't necessarily have a stance around these matters. They wake up and decide what they're going to do around the matters and stuff of that nature. Regarding coalition governments, yeah.
you've reminded me of a time when I was, I think it was the 2014 election or something, I went to a debate between the various political parties, and the ANC knew exactly how to drive the PAC up the wall. So they asked the PAC politician who was on stage, you know, we hear all the time about land this, land that. What policies do you have that don't have to do with land? And the PAC councillor said, well, you see, when you have a hospital, it's built on land.
That's actually their stance on anything. You ask them any question around governance and everything, they tell you, no, the land is central. Then where do we move to from the land? There's literally no answer to that question. They haven't been able to answer it since. But I think Marius is quite correct in saying that these coalition governments are clearly hard to manage. And one is left wondering what will happen in 2024. Will we have such a situation at the national level? And if it's such a situation that we're going to have, how do we then begin coming up with strategies that could help us avoid it as much as possible? And I think, yeah, that those are the conversations that I hope opposition parties that are looking into coming into governance, hopefully in 2024, are already having. Because really, if they don't already start working around these mechanisms, then we'll have a crisis come 2024, I reckon.
Very, very... very definitely, I think that there's a high possibility. And that's why I suggest that any South African who is trying to envision what the future may be like after 2024, after 2029, you know, whenever we get our first coalition government, should go and read about Israeli politics, particularly of the last couple of years, when I think they had, what, 4 elections in 4 years or something like that. And they have very unstable coalitions made up of everything from hardline right-wing Zionists to left-wing Arab parties, which somehow managed to form governments together. So I suspect that that's probably going to be a little bit what our future looks like. Marius, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly it. If you look at studies of coalition around the world, there's two things that make them stable. That they, first, they have to come together and agree on certain points. And there has to be some kind of ideological coherence between the parties. That's why this latest Israeli coalition lasted, I think, barely 6 months. The main reason it came to fruition was to get rid of Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's why, that, as you said, right-wing Zionists on one side and left-wing Arabs, they were together in a coalition. Once they got rid of Netanyahu, then they had to get down to the hard business of governing, and that didn't work. So they actually scheduled for another election at the end of this year already. So, but I try to people who are listening and watching, you mentioned Andile Logisa a little bit earlier. And he still sent one of the greatest tweets of all time. And this is a real tweet. I'm going to read it to you now. It's Andile Logisa. The U.S. like to play with our minds. They once reported Louis Armstrong was the first man on the moon in 1969. That was a great lie by Americans. Their aim was to ridicule the Russians. And this is a real tweet from Andile Logisa's real account. And it's still there. It hasn't been deleted. So these are the kind of people involved with the ANC, Nelson Mandela Bay, just to let everybody know. So... the great Louis Armstrong landed on the moon. And I think he was followed by his brother, Lance Armstrong, landed. He was second, I think. But yeah. So.
Yes.
That's a real tweet. It's not from a parody account. If you remember,
the NC has not been deploying its best to the to its municipalities.
The poor people of the Eastern Cape. I mean, this is the
they're unfortunately doomed to suffer, I think, in the short term. Exactly. Okay, right. So we're going to keep an eye on this story, obviously. And yeah, with all these shenanigans going on, who knows how long, if the DA does manage to topple the ANC mayor and form a coalition government there, who knows until the ANC manages to topple their government. As far as I understand, the coalition agreement put together by the DA does not, in fact, have enough seats to have an outright majority in Nelson Mandela Bay. So, oof, exciting stuff. All right, Diego. This one, I think, is about your hometown, which is Polokwane, and it is facing a bit of a water crisis at the moment. The city of Polokwane in Limpopo has experienced water shortages for the past 3 weeks due to the non-maintenance of infrastructure and system failures by the utility Lephele Northern Water, which is the company that runs the water system up there. Polokwane has been hit with intermittent water supply for several years, and as to be expected, it was a little bit like Eskom. There's been lots of talk about fixing the problem permanently, but it doesn't seem as though anything has come to fruition there. Polokwane is also seeking to become a metro, like our other big cities, and not just a normal municipality. And these crises are looking to derail that. At a media briefing yesterday, the mayor of Polokwane, John Bear, laid the blame on the utility company, saying that they breached contractual obligations to supply the city and its surround with a specific amount of water. They said that the pumps had been taken in for repairs and were never returned. The mayor said that Lephele Northern Water was only pumping 30% of the 100% required to pump to Polokwane. Over time, reliability of services deteriorated in the city of Polokwane, hence measures to restore services must be implemented immediately. The water utility has a new CEO. That is Dr. Cornelius Rater, who said that emergency repairs had started on Monday and they were hoping to fix their backup system so that if there's a shortage of water, they can quickly pump water. Tiego, what do you make of this? I don't know if you've been affected personally by the water shortages. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, luckily, Nick, I haven't personally been affected by the water shortages. And this water shortages started quite a while ago. I remember back in 2017, areas such as Flora Park, right here in Polokwane, were struggling with a similar issue. And the mayor at the time, who's now the deputy minister of COCTA, Tembinga Di Meng, whenever there was no water, would do the exact same thing that John Mpe is doing now, put the blame all together onto the Lepelle Water Board. But the crisis is actually multifaceted. There's an issue indeed with the water board. The water board is not delivering the amount of water it should be delivering. Indeed, they are delivering 30% instead of the 100%. At the water bank, there are issues around maladministration, issues around corruption. Just in 2020, there's a guy called Sefalafala. The news, the story is all over the news. His name is Sefalafala, who was paid 45 million rand by the Lepelle Water Board for doing absolutely nothing. He worked with the previous CEO, with the CEO who was in 2019, worked with him, put together contracts and everything of that nature, did no job whatsoever. Then when the CEO left and a new CEO came through, they tried forcing that CEO to make payments for the contract that was signed and no job was delivered. They ended up kidnapping the CEO. It's all over the news. Kidnapped the CEO with the help of the police. Police helped them, kidnapped the CEO, met somewhere at the petrol station to discuss these matters, to say that, no, you must pay us our claims. And that's a crisis we have in Polokwane, but here in Polokwane at the moment. But we also have a crisis with the city of Polokwane in itself. They keep on building dams all over in rural areas and stuff of that nature. In Polokwane as well, some of the areas where they build these dams, they haven't done real examinations in advance to check if water can indeed be located in those areas. So you check in Polokwane, there are some dams that are around with no water. People don't have water. There's no water around the areas because thorough studies were not done in advance. Secondly, there's the issue of infrastructure that's always breaking because, I mean, comrades in Polokwane give tenders to their comrades and they're always looking at cutting costs and using the cheapest materials so the politicians themselves can get a profit from that as well. It's a crisis that we have here in Polokwane. It's a corruption crisis, both at the city of Polokwane, at the water board, at the water affairs department as well, that's overseeing everything. The most recent report I saw from water affairs discussing water issues in Polokwane, particularly looking at Capricorn Municipality and Polokwane, I think Polokwane was delivering less than 50% of water services that they had been allocated a budget to deliver, you know. So it's really a crisis. Capricorn Municipality happens to be the only municipality here in Limpopo that's really functioning. I saw their latest report, they managed to get about 90% of their water projects done. The rest of the municipalities, some of them are sitting at 5%, some are sitting at 15, some are sitting at 30 something. It's a crisis, but it seems to be a governance crisis more than anything. But I rest assure you that the people at the Lepelle Water Board and the people at the Polokwane Board, they are quite in contact, closely in contact. And if there were such issues, they could have long raised the issues to them to say that you are not doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. As time goes, I am almost certain that we will find that there's a link between the very person who's saying that the others are the ones who are failing and them. And we might just find that they are working together in not delivering the services. That's unfortunately the state of affairs in our city and our province.
Very concerning, but not particularly surprising. We've seen a lot of things like this happen, I think, across South Africa's municipalities. And we seem to be getting quite a lot of water crises hitting our big cities. Of course, Cape Town had its famous Day Zero, which it managed to avoid, but it was still a bit touch and go there for a while. I believe Nelson Mandela Bay currently has water issues. I think Durban has water issues at the moment. Polokwane has water issues. How long is it, do you think, until Joburg is hit by such a thing?
Well, I stay in Ekurhuleni, and we often have water outages. I've gone without not having water for a week at times. So, but also, I mean, probably the water shortage that sticks in most people's minds is what happened in Cape Town and the old Day Zero thing. And people listening can probably make up their own minds why that was reported more in the media than water shortages in other parts of the country. And we know that, I mean, there's some municipalities that have had much greater water problems than places like Cape Town, but you don't really hear about them. And I think this is actually a problem in South Africa in general. If it's not happening in Joburg or Cape Town, to a lesser degree in Durban, then people don't really hear about it and it's not really such a big deal. I think it's all part of, I mean, there's a there's a different issue. That's all part of the broader decline, you know, of resources in the media. And it's a bit harder to report on what's happening in the country outside of the big places. But just on issue of Polokwane, compared to the between the 2016 and 2021 local government elections, support for the ANC actually went up in Polokwane. And for the EFF and the DA and other political parties actually went down. The DA went from about 11% of votes in 2016 to about 7% in 2021. The EFF went from nearly 30% of the vote. Polokwane was actually its best municipality in 2016 to about 22% of the votes in 2021. So I think it shows you how sticky ANC support is outside of, you know, the more urbanized provinces, Gauteng, Western Cape, to a lesser degree, KwaZulu-Natal. And I mean, if you look at the local government elections, you know, the ANC had a clean sweep just about in Limpopo. I think maybe Thabo Mbeki and I think Modimolle was the two places where they didn't get more than 50% of the votes. But just shows you how sticky ANC support is in certain places. And, you know, a lot of people are still going to support the ANC come hell or high water, you know, out of loyalty, whatever the case is. But this isn't, this is obviously not something unique to ANC supporters. You'll see it in many countries across the world where people vote for a political party because their dad voted for it and his dad voted for it and his dad voted for it or whatever the cases there might be. So, yeah, it and shows you how, you know, South African politics is complex. Even if we see this kind of infrastructure breakdown in Polokwane, we're not seeing that the ANC is getting punished at the polls for it.
Just briefly on that final point, Tiego, do you think that things might turn around for the ANC in Polokwane or do you think that it's going to be one of their strongholds going forward?
Well, I think because, you know, the main thing that's causing the ANC support not to go down in Polokwane is because the main sector that we have in Polokwane is a public sector. So majority of the people who stay in Polokwane work for the government, either in departments, municipalities and stuff of that nature. It's and really, but we'll revisit this idea another time, I think. The mentality of the people in Polokwane is quite different from the mentality of the people in Gauteng and the people in the Eastern Cape. I've gotten to live in all three provinces, and I think, yeah, it's here in Polokwane, people have the mind that the government is a god of some sort. You speak to young people about entrepreneurship. If you dare propose an idea, first thing would be, let's go to the government. I know who can find us or who can find us from the government. So there's a mental shift that needs to happen. I think, yeah, changes in Polokwane will only start coming around, or at least a change of political parties and stuff of that nature, as soon as there's a mental shift going about. People understanding that they have the powers themselves as individuals to initiate businesses, to initiate enterprises and go forward with them. But yeah, for as long as that remains what's in the mind, and it's a narrative that's pushed by politicians themselves. In Polokwane, you see how they spend money. So people aspire to become like these people that they know. And unfortunately, we don't have much successful private sector people this side. So almost young people who are growing, it's not even a matter of them voting for what their parents voted for, but a matter of them wanting to be like their neighbor who's driving a Range Rover, driving it because they have a tender at the Department of Public Works. So it's that kind of a thing. But I think, yeah, if we get the private sector moving this side, slowly but surely, I reckon that people's minds should start changing and, yeah, changes should start coming about.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very interesting. All right, let's move on to our last story for today. And this is, we're going overseas now to talk about the world's largest democracy, though, of course, being India. An endlessly fascinating country that I don't think is that well reported on by anyone outside of India, mostly because it's very complicated. So India has, for the last couple of years, essentially had a big political contest between two major parties and a whole series of regional parties. Those parties being the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the current ruling party of Narendra Modi, the BJP, and the party which led India to independence and lost control of the country in 2014 until today, and that being the Indian National Congress, the INC. It's no coincidence that the ANC and INC have a similar name. They were formed at a similar time, or at least the ANC was formed in a sort of similar mold as the INC. As part of efforts to revitalize the INC, which has really been struggling in recent years to provide effective opposition to Modi's BJP, the leader of the INC, Rahul Gandhi, who is, I think, a relative by marriage of Mahatma Gandhi. I'm not sure. Maurice,
incorrectly. He's not. Just coincidence.
Yeah, it's just a coincidence.
Yeah, it's just coincidence.
But he's the son of he's the grandson or son of one of India's previous prime ministers, I believe.
He's the grandson of the first Indian prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, whose daughter married the Gandhi, and she also became a prime minister.
Correct,
he's the third generation Gandhi
He comes from a political dynasty, so to speak. And as attempts to revitalize his party, he's going to be following in the footsteps of the famous Mahatma Gandhi, who of course is a senior it was a big influence on the INC around the time of Indian independence in 1947, by going on a 5 month long 3,500 kilometer walk through 12 of India's states. Where he will hold rallies, talk to people, meet people, and sleep in makeshift accommodation at night. The entire journey is going to be live streamed on a website, and songs will be played the entire time. It's called the Unite India March, and it's an attempt to sort of push back against the BJP's political dominance by kind of showing that they are closer to the people. It's also an attempt to turn around the party's fortunes, which have really, the INC has really been doing badly. However, the opinion polling of India, which is, I think, a little bit unreliable to some degree, is showing that he's got a very high, difficult task ahead of him. Only 9% of Indians surveyed recently said that he would make the best choice for prime minister, whereas I think over 50% said the same thing about Narendra Modi. Narendra Modi is incredibly popular in India. I think generally he has approval ratings towards sort of 70%. This is despite the fact that in the same survey, 35% of respondents say that their economic condition has deteriorated under Narendra Modi's rule. So that's pretty interesting stuff. Morris, so we're very much outsiders when it comes to Indian politics, but it strikes me that this is perhaps not the right move. I mean, it's, as a political stunt, it's quite impressive, and I'd like to see politicians from, let's say, South Africa for a start doing this. I think it would be good for someone to go for a nice long walk. But if you're just calling back to what Mahatma Gandhi did, this kind of seems like you're just sort of retreading the greatest hits. I don't know if they've got any new ideas. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And I think it's quite similar to the ANC in some ways. You know, often the ANC or the President Ramaphosa will hark back to the glory days of the ANC when it was in the struggle, you know, and fighting against apartheid. You know, the ANC is quite a backwards-looking party, I think. You know, they always look in the rearview mirror rather than through the windscreen. And I think that Congress in India is kind of similar, you know. And this is just a gimmick. You know, it's not going to change, but it's not coming up with any real reforms or what they can do to combat the BJP and make a difference. And, you know, Congress is really doing very badly. It's only got 20% of the vote in the last general election in India. I think it only governs two of the 30-odd Indian states. So it's really nowhere. But it's quite dangerous, because for all the Indian National Congress is false, you know, it's a secular party. It's, you know, supports democracy. Whereas the BJP, it's, you know, it really plays up to identity politics. You know, they basically say you can only be an Indian if you're a Hindu. And there's lots of outright discrimination and violence against Muslims, to a lesser degree Sikhs and Christians, but definitely against Muslims. So it is worrying that a party like Congress, who's always said India is for everybody, you know, you don't have to be a Hindu to be an Indian, where they're doing very badly, and where the BJP is kind of playing off this identity politics. So the ANC is probably a mix of actually the Indian National Congress and the BJP, where it's completely out of ideas, but still using these kind of identity politics things like the BJP is. So, yeah, it's so as I said, you can see the Congress is obviously completely out of ideas, but it's actually worrying. And India is obviously a very important country. It's just became the fifth largest economy in the world. It's got the second most people in the whole world, and it's probably going to overtake China this decade sometime. And as you say, it's a democracy for now. So it's definitely something that we need to keep an eye on. And, you know, we don't want India to fall also into this authoritarian trap. But to a large degree, it does seem to be happening. Democracy is sliding back in India, and it's definitely something to worry about. And yeah, I think India is also a country South Africa can learn quite a lot from. But yeah, I think it's going to go through the next couple of years for India is probably going to be a bit of a roller coaster. And Congress could play a good big role in putting India back on the right path, but let's see what happens.
It's also interesting, of course, that the INC did in fact embrace some reformist policies, very much like the ANC had embraced kind of government-centric development for most of India's history. And then the 90s changed its mind and began to chop away the bureaucracy and cut red tape and embrace some free market reforms, which went a long way towards transforming India. But the party still hasn't been able to find its footing. Tiego, briefly before we end, what do you make of all this? Do you think that South African politicians should also go for a walk across the country?
Well, I think certainly not. People will not eat a walk. I think we need to now start being. I think what needs to happen in South Africa is that we need to start being an honest man. We need to start being honest about a lot of things and fix the direction that the country is taking. Honest around issues such as paying social grants to people who have kids, someone who has 11 kids and we must pay that person. We must be honest about what's happening in our departments, in our SOEs, what's happening in our municipalities. The payroll is bloated. It must be reduced. I mean, government is overspending on salaries and stuff of that nature. I think what South Africa really needs is just an honest conversation and a dose of. I think the government needs a dose of what the IRR does on a daily basis at work. The government just needs a dose of that and that kind of thinking. Get things together, and yeah, I think from there we can move forward. I think mainly our issues lie with our thinking, really, how we come up with solutions. We think we are coming up. Well, I say we, but I refer to the government really. So I think yeah. The government really needs to sit down and rethink things. Working won't assist anything.
No, definitely. All right. That is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope that you enjoyed the show, and we will, of course, see you tomorrow for the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.